I'm Allie Weiss, and I'm obsessed with the people, ideas, and experiences that break the rules, beat the odds, or are considered socially unacceptable. And this is season 4 of Tales of Taboo. Each week, I gather anonymous confessions from my listeners around the world who've existed in elusive subcultures, ventured down the road less traveled, made serious mistakes, and achieved extraordinary victories. Some of them call my hotline, and others will send written stories for me to read. These confessions are raw, they're honest, they're even downright shocking sometimes, but they always deliver the most incredible life lessons and encourage us to consider why we're all so afraid to be different. And for season 4, I'm introducing a brand new twist. I'm starting each episode with my own, no-holds-barred, on-the-record confession about the topic we're discussing. This week, it's the world of high-end hospitality. Let's get into it. The first important memory I have that took place in a fancy restaurant was the night I found out I got into college. My family was eating at a place called Pasadís del Pep, a seafood restaurant found at the end of Barcelona's old city's most famous corridor. The walls are made of centuries-old stones and covered in oil paintings, and there's no menu. You sit and they serve whatever the kitchen feels like serving, stopping only when you're too full to breathe. The beautiful ambiance and the novelty of the experience significantly amplified what otherwise would have been truthfully a mid-level reaction to the good news. I was thrilled to be accepted because my grades were not good. The college definitely wasn't my first choice. Pasadís del Pep turned a night of fundamental relief into one that made me feel like I had won an Oscar. It was the first seed planted of my still flowering fascination with the theatrical experience of fine dining. First semester junior year at that college, I flew to Chicago to visit a friend whose formerly innocent love of Xanax and alcohol landed her in a psych ward and then outpatient rehab. Outpatient rehab, I should clarify, was more or less house arrest in her family's luxury condo, and we left it only to go to Blackbird, which is a since-closed restaurant with a James Beard Award-winning chef and a famed tasting menu. Around course 5 of 8, her parents chatted up 2 sophisticated, middle-aged people to our right who were visiting from the UK. The man, let's call him David, offered me a helping hand in London should I need one when I was studying there the following semester. And when I emailed him a few months later to accept that offer, he invited me to the fanciest lunch I've ever been to. And we started up this unconventional friendship with me at 20 years old and him at 69 years old, that mostly unfolded at luxurious Italian restaurants and openings for the Indian cafes he invested in. With each plate of pasta, piece of pakora, or glass of 1 p.m. wine served in and on immaculate china, I increasingly wondered what the hell he actually wanted with someone 49 years his junior, and whether or not that woman in Blackbird eating petit fours was his wife, and where she was in all of this. But I was too shy and afraid to ask. I didn't want to lose the glamour and the know-how that I never could have achieved myself in a foreign city. A city that largely started to feel like home because of David's access. A few weeks before I was set to return to New York, he invited me to his home for dinner instead of our usual restaurant venture. His tone was different this time, intimate and, dare I say, lustful. And so I turned it, and less directly him, down. Our friendship felt strange, but novel and extremely fun within the immersive theater of these glitzy restaurants in Soho, Shoreditch, and Bermondsey. But outside, in the real world, unprotected by the structure of 3 courses and a bill to pay at the end, it wasn't nearly as plausible or easy or safe. so I didn't see him again. On the topic of middle-aged men, I had one of the most memorable dinners of my life at the Beatrice Inn with two very well-known restaurateurs and the head of catering at a prestigious New York restaurant group. One of them is my ex-boyfriend's godfather who had invited me. I was late, and when I walked in, the hostess asked the name on my reservation. I didn't know who made it, so I just said, "It's a table of old white men." And despite the fact that the restaurant was mostly full of old white men, she somehow delivered me to the right place, which was a perfect corner table in the back room. The moment I sat down, an ice-cold dirty gin martini and sliver of homemade THC-infused caramel brittle was placed in front of me, and the games began. I look back and I can see flashes of some heavily aged and absurdly, almost offensively priced steak. Equally offensive humor flying around the table. There was some sort of red meat pot pie and get this bone marrow creme brulee. There was too much red wine and a bunch of other dishes I can't remember because of how much I drank of that red wine. And then to top it off, there was the single cigarette that we half jokingly asked for once we were wasted, which was in actuality brought to us, wait for it, on a silver platter. One cigarette on a silver platter. I can't make this shit up. What I remember of the food was good, if not a bit gaudy, but I look back on that night as one of the best meals I've ever had because of the way that I felt. I was a struggling actor in her mid-20s out for an all-expenses-paid $1,000-plus dinner in an absolutely stunning restaurant with three very well-respected men who were treating me as an equal, as a peer. We laughed until we wept. I was roaringly drunk and high off of both the substances that we consumed and the fact that I was even sitting at that table. Like, how did I finagle that? I can't imagine what the other patrons must have thought about the situation. Like, did they assume I was an ambitious, streetwise PR girl or a high-end escort with incredibly high emotional and physical stamina? A niece out for dinner alone for whatever reason with all three of her naughtily behaved uncles? Like, I'll never forget it. And there was also the time I went out on a first date with a B-list actor, not middle-aged, to clarify, and we went to a chic romantic restaurant in Los Angeles. We were seated at this outdoor table behind a tree in their sprawling garden, which was a choice that catered more to his paranoia about his fame than his actual level of fame. After all, when I met him an hour prior for getting to know you shots, as one does, at a nearby dive bar, he and his leather biker jacket and his crumpled TV script had positioned themselves directly in the middle of the bar. I have no clue what we ate, with the exception of some like run-of-the-mill roasted cauliflower, but I do remember us making out across the table before all of the appetizers had even arrived, which set the tone for the rest of an extremely wild night. We never saw each other again, but the entire encounter, many details of which are not included here, is one of my favorite stories to tell my friends. At the risk of sounding like a wannabe and quite frankly horrendous food critic, I'm going to halt our tour of memory lane right here. You get the point. Fine restaurants have served as backdrops for me to escape various societal conventions and the humdrum of everyday life and create wild stories for podcasts and cocktail parties, which is great, but this narrative is dripping in as much privilege as it is butter. That's kind of the point, though. My experiences show one side of the high-end restaurant industry, the side of the customer who has cash. The person being waited on, for whom restaurants are glamorous and special, not a way to make a daily living. For the workers on the other side, who do the cooking and the serving and the cleaning and the hosting and the accommodating of the, "We're celebrating a college acceptance, please give us a good table" reservations, you know, the people who bring the cigarettes on the silver platters, it's often a very different story. And I know this firsthand because I was a hostess for 3 years. Even though being a hostess is probably the easiest job on the roster, I was still sexually harassed, verbally abused, underpaid, and bossed around by egomaniacs. And I didn't even see anything close to the worst of it. Like, the restaurants I worked in were nice, but they were by no means institutions. The chefs who worked there were chefs with a lowercase c and not a capital one. On the other hand, our anonymous contributors work or worked at some of the greatest culinary destinations around the world and the country, the kinds that books like Sweet Bitter and movies like The Menu are written about. These are the kinds of restaurants that have celebrity chefs and celebrity clientele and Michelin stars and zero available reservations, where kitchens are treated as temples and employees are kind of expected to worship accordingly, as are the customers. The world of fine dining is inarguably controversial and divisive. You know, it creates community, but also isolates a huge amount of people who can't afford it. It's magical, and behind the scenes, it's also so grim. It's amazing artistic expression, and it's pretentious bullshit. It's culturally important, and it's tone deaf. It's everything all at once. And this is why I felt it belonged on Tales of Taboo. As always, I would love to hear all of your questions, concerns, and responses, however complicated to this topic, as well as your own memorable experiences dining in or working at restaurants, all off the record. You can reach me to chat or spill your secrets at confessions@allieweisworld.com. I'll also put that email into the episode notes as well. Time for me to stop talking. So without further ado, my lovely listeners, I'm so happy to be back. Welcome to season 4.
I started working as a host in New York City restaurants when I was in my very early 20s. It was supposed to be a quick and temporary way to make money, because after all, if things didn't work out at one place, the city had a million other restaurants with a million other jobs. The thing about hosting is that on top of expected responsibilities, you are also expected to bend over backwards and go above and beyond for guests, all while in a short black dress, high heels, and a smile. It's nothing short of a nightmare. My first ever job was at the ill-fated and misbegotten hotel on Rivington. I was fired when I walked into the office to pick up my paycheck and caught my manager doing lines of cocaine off of his desk. He quickly cleaned up his mess and gave me my check, but promptly let me go the very next time I clocked in. I was a liability, I guess. After that, I was hired at the Bowery Hotel, which has a restaurant called Gemma. The difference between the two was night and day. The Bowery Hotel was and still is the epitome of excellent service. This is actually where I learned the most about food, wine, fine dining, and hospitality. But even still, they are notorious for letting celebrities get away with quite a bit. I once watched Mark Ronson sit down at the piano in the lobby and proceed to play a bunch of different songs, leading to a sing-along with his sister Charlotte. That was a lot of fun. But I also once saw a very coked up and drunk John Mayer walking around the lobby bar singing his own songs in a weird bid for attention. When he was told by the other guests to knock it off, he proceeded to pick a fight and was literally told to go to his room. So that was not so fun. Also, Mary Louise Parker was prone to foot-stomping tantrums. She was someone who didn't like being told no. Some guests were complete sweethearts, like Mark Ruffalo, Sandra Bernhard, the director Ang Lee, and Sir Robert Plant. Having Robert Plant wander around the hotel and restaurant, chatting up the staff was such a pinch-me moment. He was the kindest, funniest, and very generous. But what led to my termination from the Bowery Hotel was one celebrity guest who wouldn't leave me alone. He's a semi-well-known British actor and would shamelessly flirt with me and the other hostesses nonstop during peak dining hours. During his stay, he relentlessly asked me out. This was long before Me Too, so I felt pressured to say yes, if only to shut him up. I clocked out, sat at the bar, and let him buy me a drink. A big no-no, as having a shift drink while the restaurant is still open is a bad look. He bought me a nasty Bellini that remained untouched while he yammered on and on about nothing and slid his fingers up and down my forearm. I so badly wanted to slap him. He downed his drink and left. I went home and thought nothing of it since I had technically clocked out. The next day, I received a call from my manager who said that despite the fact that I had clocked out, I had still broken a rule and was fired. I tried to explain that the actor wouldn't quit hounding me and that no one had stepped in to do anything. So I said yes to get him off of my case. It didn't matter to my manager, who insisted that I could have said no and fired me anyway. It kind of hurt, but I moved on. My next stop was the Standard Grill in the Meatpacking District, a place that had no standards or morals. Servers would often work their shifts drunk or high. The grill would often get a dinner rush and then a late-night crowd that would pack the place well into the early morning. After management left for the evening, everyone was pretty much on their own, including me. The girls I worked with at the grill were bitchy, stuck up, and came from well-to-do families. They didn't actually need the job. They just needed something to buy time until they got a job in fashion or married rich. The grill provided a few really memorable moments. Charlotte Gansborg once tipped me $100 for fetching her jacket from coat check. MIA is the sweetest and extremely generous, tipping everyone on the staff that she encountered. I was once asked to take a large order of prescription drugs up to the room of a well-known peroxide blonde rock star widow. I grabbed the hefty pharmacy bag and rode the elevator up to her floor. I walked over to her room and gave a few professional knocks. The door flew open and there she was, in a baby doll dress. Her skin was alabaster and she glowed. She thanked me profusely, gratitude filling her raspy voice. She slipped me a few crisp $100 bills and smiled sweetly. As I was walking away, she called out, "Hey, do you want to come and hang out?" I turned around and saw her grinning. Knowing full well that that would end badly, I regretfully declined. My time there came to an ugly finish when a well-liked food runner, aka the person that runs food from the kitchen to the tables, sexually harassed me. It was ugly and beyond vile, and I immediately reported the incident to HR, naively thinking that they'd look out for me. Historically, HR departments have always looked out for the company's well-being, not the employees. I didn't know this because I was 22. They fired the food runner the very next day, but because he'd been popular with the servers and bartenders, the staff decided to completely freeze me out. I'd be ignored, degraded, and even name-called by my coworkers. The management took notice and started whittling my shifts down. It was only a matter of time before they fired me too. I was called in on my day off, a sure sign that you're being canned, and was told that the, quote, riffraff I had caused for reporting my sexual harassment was too much and that I was being let go. They gave me my last two paychecks and wished me luck. I politely told them to go fuck themselves. But things were starting to get dark, and I found myself returning to these unhealthy environments for my bread and butter because they were the easiest jobs to get and also the easiest ones to leave. The schedule is so flexible and the money can be good. So while I avoided falling into the traps of drug and alcohol addiction, I was becoming addicted to the actual job itself. But it was an endless loop of leading nowhere because I didn't actually want to climb any kind of hospitality ladder. I didn't want to be a manager or restaurant owner at any point. I was just young and just wanted a paycheck. And yet, there was one more place I ended up getting hired at, the Waverly Inn. The pedigree of this place is ridiculous, and after my experience there, I don't think they deserve all of the praise they get. It was a sophisticated, well-lit, glossy chaos that everyone seemed to be drawn to. Here are some of the things I witnessed or was subjected to. Frequent shouting matches between the staff members and one of the managing partners. The partner had an abusive reputation throughout the industry. I personally witnessed him get angry and proceed to toss plates like frisbees across the main dining room. He would pick up chairs in the garden room and toss them across the space, too. He also used to give certain members of the staff horrible nicknames. I was called Ice Princess because I was aloof, if only to keep myself safe. And he called a manager under 5'10 Napoleon. This man would terrorize and bully everyone before the start of every dinner service. I would constantly be touched and groped by one of the line cooks whenever I went into the kitchen to post up the VIP list. I would always tell him to stop and he wouldn't, so I finally told him to fuck off. Spoiler alert, by the way, everyone thinks that they're a VIP. At the Waverly Inn, if you're not on that list, you're a nobody to them. The real VIPs that were friends with Graydon Carter would never have a bill sent to their table. Instead, the bill would be sent to their offices or homes, and an assistant would handle it. The final straw at the Waverly Inn came when the chef started visiting me at the host stand. He would vent and complain about the job, which was fine. But then he started telling me weird details about his marriage, his sex life, and at one point tried to give me a shoulder massage while I was trying to do my job. It was awful, and I reported it to the manager. This, of course, got me fired. It was 2010, and again, there was no Me Too to protect or save me. Looking back, it was a strange time. You couldn't say no to anyone or anything. You were expected to put up with tantrums, name-calling, verbal abuse from guests, sexual harassment from managers and chefs, and rampant drug and alcohol abuse from all angles. I certainly hope that things have improved, but even now when I dine out myself, I still have trouble relaxing as I know exactly what is going on at all times. It's sort of a hard mindset and world to escape from. I think that once you've done time in the trenches of fine dining, you're officially a member of the type of club that you never wanted to be in.
Written submission number one. I was a waitress slash bartender in two Michelin star restaurants in London, one in Mayfair, one in Shoreditch. My boyfriend at the time was a chef there and we were living together, so I can relay what his life was like. I always saw hospitality as an easy, shitty part-time job while I was at university. I have ADHD and had substance abuse issues, so what better place to spend my evenings than at a busy, booze-filled venue? For the chefs, it was a mixture of either they went to culinary school at 16 and had this rise and grind mindset, or it was a blasé trust fund kid that wasn't smart enough or got burned out in a corporate environment. The owner of the first place I worked at was a fail son of some lord. You can imagine, posh London family, oldest kid goes to Cambridge, the youngest has no talent or motivation and a ketamine issue, parents give him $100,000 to open a restaurant. Since it was my part-time job, I didn't care that much and thought the money was okay-ish. It was 2016 to 2018, so I assume it may be different now, but I was making roughly 10 to 12 pounds per hour. I was working part-time, so my shifts were usually on weekdays, 5 p.m. to 2 or 3 a.m., or weekends from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. The length of the shift depended on how busy the bar got once the kitchen was closed. I also had to make cocktails for chefs and friends of the owners after they closed in a lock-in, so as long as they had the bags flowing, I'd serve them. Chef salaries were outrageously low. My boyfriend, after 2 years of working 15 hours a day, had to beg for a pay raise from £22,000 to £25,000 a year. And mind you, I was 21 and he was 31, so this money was definitely embarrassing for him. And the restaurant pooled tips, including with the back of house staff who have no customer interactions. I assume 90% of the tips were also taken by the owners. London tipping culture is very poor and rare regardless, so a lot of waitresses would steal them while cleaning up tables if no one was looking. I swear to God, not a single restaurant I've worked at or heard of made any money. I was begging to believe it's either a money laundering scheme or just draining out daddy's account. Obviously, good-looking girls were sent to tables full of corporate men. My restaurant had rotating head chefs, and if the menu that week was from any Asian country, and I mean no difference whether it was Japan or Bangladesh, they would push my boyfriend to the front to show him off, since he was Asian and the only POC in the building. TV shows are pretty accurate when it comes to depicting the chaos of a kitchen. It's also very much dependent on if the kitchen is open, meaning the customers can see the chefs, in which case they obviously behave better. They don't abuse each other and the waitresses won't pinch your ass while you walk by and call you a retard if you ordered the wrong plate. If the kitchen is closed, all hell breaks loose and I would rather die than enter a space like that again. It was before Me Too, so the jokes were savage. Constant rape and racist jokes from absolutely anyone, thrusting motions behind you when you weren't looking. It's a super high testosterone, male-driven environment. The worst abuse you could get was from a coworker who was only a tiny bit higher in the hierarchy than you. It was a chain of abuse, so as soon as someone got some power over you, they'd use it immediately, make you scrub the floor and pour them drinks while they flirt with customers. And all chefs are functioning alcoholics. When my boyfriend would come home after a shift, he couldn't switch off and would constantly tell me to, quote, shut the fuck up, or if I wouldn't chop bread for our breakfast well enough, he would say, quote, a monkey or, insert an African kitchen porter's name, could do it better. He became super abusive as the time went on, coming home after 15 or 16 hour shifts, coked up and drunk. He'd piss in our wardrobe or vomit in our bed and then gaslight me into thinking it was me, despite me sleeping there sober because it was my uni exams. I started binge eating and drinking as well. Since there was so much tempting food around, I'd just stuff my face with whatever I saw and would run to the bathroom to throw it all up. Most chefs I encountered glorify having burns and scars and cuts on their hands and wrists to show manual labor, despite most of them being posh private school kids and heiresses spending £40,000 for tuition and cosplaying working class. They're only friends with other Michelin restaurateurs, and every single one of these places has sexual assault allegations. They're also all obsessed with Noma, the Copenhagen restaurant deemed as the best in the world at the time. For the vibe reference, watch the movie The Menu. They also all refuse to eat normal food since their taste buds are completely melted off from tasting salted butter all day. The only cuisine they like is fast food, and they can't even enjoy the perk of a nice home-cooked dinner. Some gross and juicy details. We went feral behind closed doors for half-eaten desserts. One time I was hungover and hungry during my shift and scooped out a meal from the trash since it didn't touch anything else. I shoved it in my apron pocket and ate it in the bathroom with my bare hands. Also, our delivery food boxes from Thailand almost always contained a live tarantula hiding in between coconuts. We hosted the launch of Glossier UK, and the influencers we invited were absolutely filthy, leaving vomit and shit all over the bathrooms. During staff parties, pretty much nothing was off limits. Whether people were married, living with their partners, 30 years older, everyone was hooking up. The best night was when our restaurant got the Michelin star. It was the most drug-fueled evening of my life. Unfortunately, no one thought about the fact that you need to maintain that star, and they lost it 2 years later. There was a super high ratio of staff that started off at the same time and age as me, making fun of that place as being just a temporary shit solution while they either graduate or figure out what they want to do, who are still working there. After working in the industry for a while, it becomes really difficult to go to a normal job, especially when you're struggling with addiction. I quit as soon as I could to get an office job. It was honestly the most toxic industry ever. And I now work on a trading floor, so I can handle a bit of bullying. Everyone drawn to the kitchen is an aggressive, coked-up narcissist. It's just food. It's not that deep.
So I've worked in a few high-end fine dining restaurants here in London, in the UK, more specifically a one-star, which was Davison Brook, owned by Daniel Hume of EMP in New York. And the other one was a two-star that I'm not going to name, but it's highly ranked in the world's 50 best restaurants. And I'm currently working for a restaurant where we don't have any accolades, but we are definitely pushing for a Michelin star. So I work in the wine side of things. And whether that's been in a sommelier team or within sommelier management or the restaurant management, and always wanted to work in wine. So this is very much a career path for me. And if you want to work in wine and want to really be selling the best wines and be selling the most, it's really best to work in the kind of Michelin star fine dining environments. When I was at the two star, we worked insane hours. Sometimes I'd be there from 9 a.m. till kind of 1 a.m., 2 a.m. and back at 9 a.m. the next day. Davison Brook was one of the most functional, organized, and just incredible restaurants I'd ever worked for. It wasn't micromanaged really, but there was a particular way that things needed to be done. But the two-star that I worked at was the most disorganized, chaotic restaurant I think I've ever worked in my life, which is crazy when you think of a restaurant with accolades that it had. Like, it won awards every year. It was really well thought of. Sometimes the dishes would change, like, last minute. We didn't know if staff were coming in. The restaurant would never be set up on time. People wouldn't turn up for briefing. And there was rules of how things should be done, but the staff that had been there for years didn't seem to adhere to those rules. And then it was always really confusing when you'd have new staff coming on. It was really hard to train people. I'd say the most gross thing that I've witnessed, kind of in restaurants in general, in every single restaurant that I've worked at, is the cutlery. Honestly, I feel like it's not as clean as you think it is. And even now I'm at quite a small restaurant where I have to jump in sometimes and help polish cutlery. And when it comes out of the machine, it's disgusting. There is definitely always some sort of kind of sexual drama or sexual tension going on in restaurants. It's a very incestuous place to work. And I met my current partner working in restaurants. And actually, I think every relationship I've had has been from someone that I've worked with, from a coworker. I've definitely seen at the two Michelin star I worked at, chefs being verbally abused. And I'd say the owner there was pretty insane. And he has a reputation within the industry for being absolutely insane and demanding things that are impossible.
and having completely unrealistic expectations and then basically just kind of forcing people out because people want to be treated like human beings and don't want to be treated like slaves. At Davies and Brooke, though, Daniel Hume was wonderful and I have nothing bad I could ever say about him. He created such a wonderful restaurant and such an incredible team. Really made everyone feel like we were in it together and that he really cared about each one of us. He probably knew none of our names, but he made you feel like he did, which I really appreciated. I've definitely dealt with a lot of kind of high profile and celebrity clients. Of course, being in London, a few members of the royal family who are always very, very well behaved. Lots of big celebrities as well. I say Bono from U2 loves Chateau de Cam, sweet wine from Bordeaux. Very Wang, she loves Burgundy wine and she doesn't really eat anything, which I think is not overly surprising. If you look at her, I think she just had like a couple of oysters when we did a full tasty menu, but she just wanted some oysters and caviar. And so we did provide that for her. But also served people like Paul McCartney, Caitlyn Jenner, lots of members of the Saudi royal families, political people, actors, singers, influencers for sure. They kind of all just blur into one, to be honest. No one's ever really been that rude. It's more normal people who are sometimes the rudest and most demanding. Probably the coolest moment, pitch me moment, was when I was serving Channing Tatum and I accidentally walked into him, didn't even realize who he was. And then I turned around and I was like, oh my God, that is Channing Tatum. And then I was on his wine service the entire night where he was drinking great Bordeaux wine with Matthew Vaughn, a famous film producer. That was really cool. And also having guests come in and spend crazy amounts of money on bottles of wine. I had some guests spend well over 10 grand on singular bottles of wine. But definitely when I was at Davies Brook, every week we would have kind of actually almost every night, we would have bottles over $500. Every now and then guests spending like £5,000 on bottles of wine. And I think the coolest one I tried was the champagne from 1983 from Ceylon, which I think we sold for about 5,000, which was pretty awesome. The hospitality industry definitely has a reputation for partying very hard. But I will say the kind of Michelin star restaurants I worked at, I never really got into it. At Davies and Brooke, there wasn't that culture. At the two star though, there definitely was a culture of on Saturday night because we were always closed on Sunday. There would be drinks and drugs, lots of Coke going around. I'm not really into that. So I would always have a couple of glasses of wine and then go home. But people would be at work till 7 a.m. the next morning, still partying. And sometimes we'd just go on like an all-day Sunday bender and then come to work on Monday, just destroyed. I think people would be surprised about the amount of work that goes on before and after service as well. I would sometimes be there till 3 a.m. changing a wine list because it needs to be up to date. It's not just about waiting on people. There's admin, there's doing deals, there's selling, there's cleaning. There's organization. It's really a little bit of everything. So I still work in the industry and I think I will probably forever. I left Davies and Brooke because it closed. And then I left the two star because I did not like working there and I got offered a better role elsewhere. It is pretty cutthroat, can be very glamorous and rewarding depending on the restaurants you work at. I've also been invited on lots of trips. I get gifted bottles of wine. I know colleagues who have made connections with guests and then have had those guests take them out for dinner. So I think if you choose the right place and you choose kind of the right position, it can be very rewarding and you can really get a lot out of it.
Written submission number 2. I worked in events at a Michelin-rated restaurant in the Flatiron District of New York City. The restaurant was owned by two wonders, a restaurateur and a chef, when I started, but during my time there, the two of them split and the chef became the sole owner. I started in film PR events and networked with the sister location of this restaurant. 2 weeks later, I received an email asking to meet me for the events position. Fine dining was never a passion of mine, and I had never worked in a restaurant before, so the prospect of working here was quite daunting. But I knew, given the reputation of the restaurant, that I would learn a lot, and it would steer my career in a promising direction, which it did. I was paid $60,000, which was decent in my mind since I had less than a year of work experience under my belt. It was about a year after my graduation. I kept fairly normal hours, typically Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., or later if there was an important event taking place. I did work probably one Saturday a month on average if there was a wedding or a larger event taking place over the weekend. But despite being fully booked on most nights, I did get the impression that the restaurant was, in a sense, counting pennies. I think this might have pertained to the split of the two owners with legal fees, buying the other out, etc. The celebrity chef was quite aloof and seemed nice enough to me. I didn't interact with him often, and since I didn't work in the kitchen, probably was not exposed to him in the same way that some of my back-of-house colleagues were. The book Sweet Bitter was a bit romanticized, but was actually written by someone who worked at a somewhat related establishment, and it caused a lot of drama, apparently. The writer and I had mutual co-workers. The TV show The Bear was very accurate. I think the restaurant I worked at was actually mentioned at one point in it. My workplace was incredibly organized, i.e., the masking tape used to label and date fresh produce had to be cut with a knife and could not just be torn. Plates were dropped in incredibly specific ways. Walking in the dining room and kitchen followed a pattern. Everything was done with intention. For people who worked front of house, they could only wear stud earrings, hair in a ponytail, and bridal color nail polish. I had certain non-negotiables I had to abide by, which included replying to all emails in my inbox the day they were received or before 10 a.m. the following morning if received after 6 p.m. My manager would check that my inbox could not be scrolled at the end of each day. I'm not sure why she checked, considering I never left it in a bad way. On average, I probably sent 100 emails every day. My manager was incredibly emotionally abusive. I heard they hired my position externally because nobody already at the restaurant wanted to work under her. I couldn't ask her questions without being ridiculed or reprimanded. Again, I was young and had never had a serious job before, let alone even worked in a normal restaurant. I wasn't allowed to yawn in front of her. I wasn't allowed to sigh to myself in exasperation when a particularly high-maintenance event host called five times a day, yet I saw her flip off the phone receiver while on calls a few times. She sat a foot away from me and would place sticky notes on my monitor as I talked to a guest, telling me not to say certain things. Once, she told me I shouldn't say, "no problem," to a guest, and then proceeded to answer the phone and say it to her guest. For my events, she forced me to tell the host no more than she ever did for her own, which obviously put me in a tough situation. Guests were never fun to tell no, especially when it was a request that I could have done so easily. Once I even had someone show up to my work like a stalker, and I told her and she did nothing. Didn't reach out to HR or let the other managers know. She also assigned me books to read in my free time and would quiz me on them and told me I had an attitude problem because I mentioned that I didn't think a colleague liked me much. Mind you, my manager was only like 4 years older than me, not a 50-year-old or something like she sounds like. I could go on. I'm not sure I've ever disliked a human more. I never got positive feedback. Also, I only had 5 days off a year, including sick days. People were definitely drinking the Kool-Aid given its reputation, myself included, which is why I didn't leave sooner. It was a very dog-eat-dog world, lots of bitterness with promotions, infractions, think middle school timeout, or if something happened to go wrong. I don't think people were particularly happy there given the stress that we were put under by management. A big moment for me personally was when I realized I would have to make the decisions and manage a lot of the back of house and front of house teams, despite being the youngest and newest member at the restaurant, because nobody wanted to be in the firing line if something went wrong. Chefs that worked there for years made me choose how a side dish was cooked because they didn't want to get in trouble in case they chose wrong. I had annoying guests, but no one was ever terrible. Occasionally, there would be a group that would complain the food was awful and request a refund for a $20,000 event a week later, despite no complaints being made while they were actually eating the food. We had to Google stalk guests before they came in, but since I worked with a lot of celebrities and crazy people at my internship and film events prior to the restaurant, no one struck me as that insane. The kitchen and front of house teams went out after service each night until like 2 a.m., drinking and doing God knows what. Because they worked weird hours, their friend groups were also in the restaurant. The restaurant was their entire life. Everyone fucks everyone. It's so gross. Someone high up on the beverage side cheated on his wife, who also works in the same department, with a younger girl who's also in the same department. Everyone knew about it too. But my hours permitted me to maintain a somewhat normal social life. It was a lot of work and very emotionally draining because of who my manager was. I think my experience might have been entirely different if I'd had someone else because I really enjoyed many of my colleagues. It felt like boot camp. I didn't realize that environment wasn't normal until I started at a different company. I have no idea how I managed that stress while I was there. Only a year, and I was so young. When the pandemic came, they told me I was losing my job without any warning. I could have guessed it was coming because all our events were canceling, but it still hurt since it was so abrupt. They did it in my normal weekly meeting, so I really had zero idea. Overall, I learned a ton and became a go-getter because I had to be, but I definitely have PTSD, which I'm constantly apologizing to my current amazing teammates for, since I think I'll have imposter syndrome forever, regardless of the job or how good I am. I'm still working in events now, and I absolutely adore my job. But it is not in fine dining anymore, and I will gladly never work in that industry again.
I worked in a Japanese Michelin star restaurant in Europe. How I entered into the job initially was the owner had another restaurant really close to where a place I was managing. We were street neighbors. I always thought he was really kind and humble in how he appeared to me and how he portrayed himself to everyone, especially on social media. And he just seemed like this really nice Japanese man who wanted to open up this amazing restaurant. So when he started advertising that he was looking for servers for his new upcoming Michelin project, I decided to go ahead. Definitely in the restaurant and the vibe and the brand was not actually what I thought it was. We all could have taken this man in front of many tribunals, but nobody has spoken up. So the restaurant itself is quite culturally significant because it was the first of its kind in my country. Also as well, because he was Japanese and he was an immigrant, he had a wife who was from Europe and they'd met there and come over here. And now he was just like, seemed like this really hardworking, kind, humble man who was really quiet and calm and wanted to make this amazing new restaurant. He used to portray this image of humbleness, respect, kindness, calmness, Japanese serenity, when in fact what actually transpired in there could not have been further from the truth. He was super aggressive. We used to call him the Eye of Sauron because he would be at the chef's table and staring you down, like with his arms folded. Even customers commented sometimes like, oh, he's kind of a bit more ferocious than I expected. They had no idea. Our shifts were so long and our money was so crap. As I said, the money was terrible, but the tips were really good. And once he saw how good the tips were, he actually wanted to implement a standard where nobody tipped because he didn't feel like we deserved them. This, by the way, is money that we needed for not starving to death and also deserved because we worked hard under this crazy dictator man in this tiny, tiny, tiny space. The place was meticulously micromanaged in another way. There was this South American woman who had been with him for 3 months as a being trained up before the restaurant opened. And she was literally the definition of a chocolate teapot. The useless. This woman would tell us that such and such a fish in such and such a dish was X fish. And then I would say, or someone else would say, I'm pretty sure chef said it was this other type. She would berate us and be like, I am your manager. You need to show me the respect everyone shows chef, all this. And we're like, girl, respect is earned, not given. But we would go down to the table and say this, and then the chef would come over and be like, are you stupid? That is not that fish, that's this fish. And I told you in briefing, and she would just constantly gaslight us, constantly lie. The gaslighting was happening from the top down. The micromanaging was insane. We were so stressed out about centimeters of chopsticks being correctly lined up against napkins. But on the important things, he wasn't teaching us like how he particularly wanted this plate put down or how he wanted you to describe the dish, because we used to have to describe every dish. Never told us any of that, but everything was our fault. We were stupid. We were ignorant. We were Western monkeys. We had stupid Western brains. We couldn't figure this out. This would never happen in Japan. We're making a joke out of him. All these lovely things just to hear for 12, 13 hours a day right in your ear while he's also staring at you while you are nervously trying to explain what you're doing. I didn't have a problem with it at the beginning though, because I had a good relationship with him, as I said. He then, as soon as I came in, started trying to pit me against this woman, so he'd obviously been sick of after 3 months of dealing with her. I was told off premises by her after coming in for a meeting that You know, he wanted her to step down and me to take over the restaurant. All this was perfect. I was supposed to be getting a new raise of $33,000 a year instead of $25,000. So I came in after 12 hours after asking this first manager, who said to me, you know, it's quite obvious I'm not really doing a great job at this. You know, like, you'd be better this time and I'd be better at doing this. And this is really what Chef wants. I asked her, please don't say this to anyone, because I just had a feeling this isn't going to go how it's going to go. Came in the next day. Turns out he had told his wife, who was a business partner, that he was bringing me forward as restaurant manager. And she was like, no. We've trained this other girl for 3 months. Just keep it going. And then the first manager acted like I completely, like, we had never had the conversation the next day. And was just like, what? No, this is my job. I'm doing this. Had a new lease of life in her, we'll say. Whereas I'm like bawling crying, because not only have I just briefly been given this role and told that this is what's happening, and I'd been doing all her work for her anyway and covering her ass, that now it was taken away and that they were actually going to give me $25,000. So everything was wrong. He corrected my speech. Apparently I said very too much. My earrings were too dangly. My shoes were too shiny. My lipstick was too vibrant. So I used to wear like a nude kind of lip gloss that was like super unintrusive. Apparently that was too vibrant. So I had to start wearing a pink one that he didn't like either. So then I had to start wearing another one. Basically, he wanted us to be invisible. Not only did so many people leave, especially in the first few days and weeks, but people began to leave before and after me. Things have always been on PC in restaurants behind the scenes. You know, you're spending a lot of time in a room with the same people. You would just end up having a bit of fun. But there are certain things that cross the boundary. So one chef actually was kind of being berated by him quite a bit, even though he was one of the sous chefs. The male Japanese executive chef, after he would get the kitchen porter after our staff meal, he would get the kitchen porter to go upstairs and get his pillow and blanket and take a nap on the couch while everyone prepared everything for him. He went into this one chef and walked up to him, put his hands in his ass crack through his chef's pants, and pulled some pubes out of his ass. Obviously, I think that's probably one of the weirdest but most painful things someone could do to someone in the kitchen. Super strange. And obviously this guy, let's call him James, freaked out and was like, don't ever do that again, man. And because he raised his voice to the executive chef full on kicked him in the middle of the kitchen in front of everyone and shouted at him that if they were in the Japan, that this would never happen. And he would punch him in the face and how dare he disrespect his head chef. His head chef who just pulled a pube out of his ass in front of about 5 people. So James, we'll call him, left, took a cigarette, went back working, and then was like, actually, no, I'm gone, and rightfully left. There was another girl who was his assistant, we'll say, in their first restaurant, the more casual ones, that on a staff party, he kept trying to kiss her, and she was like, not here, not here. And he was like, please, please. So God only knows what was happening there. Also, his wife was a wife at the time was a part owner of the restaurant where we worked. And he would frequently come in on Thursdays and Fridays and tell the chefs about how he had just gotten a happy ending with his massage and tell them in great detail about it. While his wife owned 49% of the company and frequently came in as a diner. In fact, she was the diner that was my worst and most controversial person in the whole place. She was so nasty, so horrible. To be fair, she probably had a dog's life living with that dude. But she was pretty much a trip as well. That place put me back on my anti-anxiety medication. So I was drinking more. I was breaking up with my ex. I was back on my anxiety medication. I never felt more disrespected, more abused. The way he used to speak about female staff members to male members, the way he used to speak about female clientele as if they were dogs, and just everything was so past the point of un-PC. It was actually abusive and destructive. I don't think anyone really knows how bad it is in there, which is why I'm really glad to say, except we should probably have a support group of people who've left there, but and a lot of us have kept in touch and all despise this man. But he still, to this day, has got a pretty good reputation, and he's still doing his thing and abusing people and still being really horrible, but people just don't know about it because it's a super small restaurant. But yeah, he was a dick. When I eventually was leaving, He got wind that I was quitting and he fired me in front of everybody. And when I say everybody, I mean all the staff, all the chefs, his wife and his two kids, and reduced me to tears because I wasn't expecting it. And even the horrible manager who left quite quickly after me because there was no one else to do her work, she was even saying to me, don't let him see you cry. Don't let him see you cry. She's like, I'm so sorry. I didn't know he was going to attack you like this, like verbally, everything, physically about my appearance. I was slim at the time, but he was very fat phobic. And I mean, he was no spring chicken himself. Yeah, it was absolutely horrible and probably the worst mental health states I've ever been. And then a few weeks later, when the other manager left, he said to another friend of ours, do you think that me, let's call me Amanda would come back? I think I backed the wrong horse. No, chef, Amanda's never coming back.
Written submission number 3. I entered the culinary field recently. I studied psych in college and then went into working in social services. When I was 18, I was sent to intensive wilderness therapy. I decided after that experience, I wanted to help people who went through a similar experience. So after school, I started working at an inpatient halfway house as a mentor. Then COVID hit and a lot of the 25 participants in the house left because it was crowded. Work slowed down and I decided to go to culinary school. I always had a passion for cooking and hosting. I'm a very artistic person and food has always been my medium. Culinary school was an absolute mess. I was 27 and most of the people in my class were 18-year-old boys from the South who just wanted to smoke things and hated vegetables and wanted to make pub food. The classes were online part-time and in-person the rest. Halfway through my courses, a mass shooting happened on campus at King Soopers, the grocery store next door. Someone I knew was murdered, and I became crippled with anxiety about going to class, so I made up every excuse to continue class at home online via Zoom. I was desperate to work in fine dining and started working at a tasting menu pop-up in Denver called The Guest. The chefs were a hot young married couple who met in kitchens in NYC. They started a tasting menu from their home during COVID, and I became obsessed with them. One of them had connections with a fine dining restaurant on the Lower East Side and gave me the email of the chef and owner. My boss is a young celebrity chef. He started serving tasting menus when he was 11. His mother made a documentary about him and the fame and criticism followed. His reputation is that he's rich and had everything handed to him, but it's not true. His mom is an independent filmmaker and his dad is a plumber. He's the hardest working person I've ever met. He's passionate about everything. He woodworks and builds everything in his restaurants himself. He's even our plumber some days. I see him in a hazmat suit covered in shit when the pipes burst, which happens a lot. He'll do everything to make sure that the restaurant is perfect and that service happens. I'm the prep cook and line cook for my station, so my shifts are 12 to 14 hours long. My tasks never stop, and I often don't have time to pee or drink water. I have to cut 350 diamond-shaped onions every day. It's tedious, and it feels like there's never time. I get paid minimum wage for back-breaking work, but I make more than most cooks in New York City, around $1,000 to $1,200 a week because I get tipped out. I'm grateful, but it's not enough for the amount of labor I put in. Cooks are desperately ripped off. Fortunately, we all love each other and have fun while making sure everything is perfect. Every service has been a well-oiled machine because the people and cooks I work with are incredibly good at what they do. Food is their passion and their life. There is barely any management on behavioral code because no one has time for that. The only thing that is meticulous is the food. Fine dining is inherently pretentious, that's a given. Throughout my career, I've worked with some chef bros who try to act like they know everything and they're God's gift to earth. But they're only human and fuck up too, and it's best to always point that out. That's how equality is created in the kitchen with chef bros. Dish it back and plate faster than them. That is power in a kitchen. My favorite celebrity guest was Abby from Broad City. She was an angel, very kind and cool. All the rest are kind of a blur. The most annoying customers are the people who stay until 1 in the morning and take 40 minutes for each dish in a 10-course menu. That's fucked and has happened a lot. They don't have a clue. Fine dining is perfect for someone with ADHD like me. I've learned organization skills and task management like I never knew before. It's been a shot to my system in a good way. but I do have a hard time with a work-life balance. I had an emotional breakdown in the beginning of my career when I was being verbally abused. I lied and said there was a family emergency, left for 2 weeks and was manic and up and down. But I came back and became a better cook and the abuse stopped. It's unfortunate what I experienced, and it should never be like that when someone is learning. I still hold the tension from that abuse in my body. Half of my time on my days off are spent getting massages and trying to release everything from being on my feet. It feels like another job. I honestly haven't been one to watch the shows and the movies or read books about restaurants. When I've tried, they're all so cringe, and it's hard to watch your job played out. I think it's great that people are becoming more interested in the life of a cook, but the darkness of kitchen life shouldn't be what people care about. What I care about is making society understand the value in the process. The people I'm serving often don't care about me or the food. They care about being seen, getting a picture, and looking hot. It's funny and pathetic at times because behind it all is a farmer fighting to keep their land and their livelihood. Chefs and farmers deserve a fair and livable wage. Service and manual labor jobs are what feed people, and they're anything but glamorous. My job is to display what someone else has spent their whole year growing. And that's it.
I've worked in like literally every kind of restaurant in New York City. I worked in a 3-Michelin-star restaurant. I worked in a Midtown steakhouse that I'm pretty sure is run by, you know, Eastern European mafia. I worked in a West Village Italian restaurant, another West Village restaurant that was high end. And all of those jobs were front of house positions. So, I mean, every kind, like host, bartender, server. I was assistant manager at one point in one of the restaurants. I was a food runner. I worked in reservations in the restaurant offices. I was a maitre d'. And the way I got into restaurants, you know, really was because I needed a survival job. And I really did love restaurants. I just love them in general. It could be hard, it could be really hard working in them, but I did love them, even though, you know, my true passion was outside of that, and it was to perform. Sweet Bitter, I remember when I read the book and watched a couple episodes of the show, and I felt like when they were illustrating, like, going out after a shift, like her first time going out with her coworkers after a shift, like that felt very real to me. I remember, like, you know, being brought back to the first time I was going out with my coworkers in the New York restaurant that I worked in as a server the first time. And I just felt it was so cool. It was so cool to go to, like, you know, these late night spots where, like, around the corner, it's this French bistro that's open till 4 o'clock in the morning. And so we're all sitting together and getting oysters and steak tartare. I just remember, like, This is so cool. You know, thinking about any specific rules and behavioral code that you have to follow at certain places. I mean, meticulousness. I mean, of course, everything was pristine. Everything was just in the most perfect condition. I remember getting a tour of the kitchen for the first time and I was just blown away. Like, not just by, like, the look of this incredibly beautiful kitchen, but the cleanliness of everything. Pretentiousness, honestly, most of the time comes from the customers and not from, you know, the staff and the people you're working with. A lot of people have asked me about, like, discrimination and sexism and any abuse. But I remember there was a restaurant I worked at. This is in the West Village. It's still there, but it's under new ownership. But at the time, the executive chef was a part owner. And so he was involved in the hiring process, you know, for front of house staff, which is, you know, not typical. And I just remember it was just such a bizarre experience and really one of the worst experiences I've ever had. The chef, it's so hard because, like, you see him as a guest judge on a lot of food competition shows. So it's hard for me to watch. I remember, you know, talking to the general manager and then they said, okay, now we want you to talk to the chef. And I sat down with him and he just had such an odd way of, like, conversing and interviewing me. He just kept saying, you know, why should I hire you? To, like, give me a good reason why I should hire you. I did not know how to answer him. I was just like, I literally said at one point, I was just like, I mean, if you don't think I'm right for this, then you don't have to hire me. They hired me. I was trying to carry these plates and he would come downstairs, you know, to go to the walk-in and get stuff. And then he would look at me and he would say, like, you're never going to be able to do that. There was one pre-shift meeting where this is after we had family meal and we're going over specials that, like, he picked on me and he
demanded that I stand on a chair and recite like all of these dishes. I had to one night stand in the kitchen. It's like part of training. Usually that, like, you know, you're standing at the pass and you're watching food come out and you usually get to taste that food. And he kept calling me names. It was just like all so sexual. And it was like in front of the whole staff. Finally, this was like a month in or so. I was just so anxious and stressed out every time I had to go into that restaurant. I just really didn't want to go. And I had gotten a call from my mom that my grandpa had passed away. And this is so terrible, but like one of the first things I thought was like, oh, I don't have to go into work tonight. And so I called and I said, I can't come into work tonight. I'm going back home, you know, and I said that my grandpa had passed. And also, when I called the restaurant, I asked to speak with the general manager, which is who you speak to when it comes to like calling out or like being sick or anything like that. Whoever it is that I spoke to at first, they put the chef on the phone. Like he wanted to talk to me and he said, I don't believe you. I was like, I don't know what to tell you. If you don't believe me, you don't believe me. And then I said, well, I quit. I don't want anyone to feel like that's defining of the industry. There are actually some pretty amazing people who work in the industry. I remember Justin Timberlake being not nice at all. I think he was like gearing up to like perform at Madison Square Garden and he came in for lunch and I was maitre d' at that point at this restaurant and he was like just so dismissive and like didn't make eye contact but he would talk to like the guests who would like either come up to him and say like how much of a fan they were or, you know, like he was really nice to them. He was really nice to guests who would say something to him, who wanted to take a picture. And I think I had said at one point, like, you know, I'm a really big fan. And he was just like, oh yeah? When I was maitre d' at this restaurant and Drew Barrymore just like walked in and we coincidentally had this film crew in during a brunch service. They were filming an episode for like an HBO show or a Showtime show. And she walked in and I was in such shock that I was just like, oh, they're waiting for you. And she was like, who? And I pointed to the camera crew. She was like, I don't know them. I don't know why I said that. And she was like, I'm hungry. But she and I like really connected after she ate and she was about to leave over like one of her movies that is just one of my most favorite movies of all time. We just had like this long conversation that ended with like her holding my hand and crying. And it was like, it was so incredible. In what other industry do things like that really happen? I'm not in the industry anymore, actually. Well, not really. So now I'm getting my MBA and I'm going to be a consultant, but I'm still doing some independent consulting for some local restaurants, which has been really amazing. And I really love it. And it reminds me that I actually really did love it. I loved being in the industry.
Written submission number 4. I went to 2 years of college and due to finances wasn't able to attend for the rest. Despite applying to other schools, I couldn't finish applying for transfer because Pratt Institute withheld my transcripts since I owed them money. So I stayed in New York City and started working at restaurants. To me, it seemed like the most accessible way to make fast cash with the experience I had. My general experience at each restaurant was tons of labor, emotional labor, and sexual harassment from the guests and staff members alike. Until one day, I was walking around the West Village and saw a gorgeous neon sign of Red Hot Lips. I saw Champagne Parlor and was tempted to go in for a glass of bubbles. I entered to be greeted by a chipper maitre d'. She told me, no, we're closing up shop for the night. I asked if I could take a look around and was pushy about it. She let me, and I chatted with her for a bit, and she asked if I was looking for work. I said yes. She asked if I had experience in champagne, which I did not. She handed me the wine list and her phone number, and the next week I was slinging sparkling wine from around the world and dancing all night. As a wine server there, you were the busser, runner, cleaner, polisher. It was hard work, lots of physical labor. You kept it together on the floor, and it all seemed glamorous, fun, and powerful. The owner had a different ethos than most bosses. She said her management style was laissez-faire. The rules were no rules. She hated the rigidity of other restaurants, so she didn't have managers, HR, anyone breathing down your neck. They had just opened that year, and it was on us to create a culture. As servers, we were the party. Most people came to the bar to party with us, listen to our music, and take our recommendations on what bougie bottle they should splurge on. If people were disrespectful or hateful, we had full control to ask them to leave. It was the safest space I had been working in since working in the industry. But the only people who had immunity were our investors, and we had one particularly creepy one. He was intimidating, in his 60s. He and his wife would come in often, usually bringing their Republican friends. He would get drunk and start getting really touchy and often whisper gross things in my ear. He would even force some people, including myself, to drink out of his champagne glass. No one felt comfortable speaking to him about his behavior. All of a sudden, I had a family. If we weren't at work together, then we would certainly be with each other on our days off. As a team, we would go to the beach, have group dinners and parties, and even travel to Italy together. I quickly became the in-house photographer and graphic designer, and then, when business started expanding, I became my boss's personal assistant too, all in addition to my service duties. A year in, and I was working at 4 of my boss's restaurants. I was burnt out. However, I was also intoxicated by the business. I loved what we stood for, I loved learning about the wines, and the coworkers had become my family. When 2 new restaurants opened, I quickly became involved with a much older chef. He sort of swept me off my feet. After we became official, I found out he was my boss's ex. Much of his behavior toward me is now considered grooming. Before I knew it, I was wrapped up with an addict who was manipulative and verbally abusive. He was rude to a lot of the staff, constantly on coke or drunk at work. Once, before my shift, he told me he was going to end his life, which was something he told me often to manipulate me into staying with him. I rushed over to his apartment, which was conveniently located above one of the restaurants. When I got there, he was fine, just drunk, and told me, "Don't worry, I'm too arrogant to ever kill myself." This situation wrecked me. I was newly 23 and felt trapped. I went downstairs to work but couldn't stop crying. My boss pulled me aside and lectured me on how this relationship was interfering with my job and how basically I was too good for this. She sent me home for the night and it felt like the walk of shame. I started hating myself for getting into the situation. Meanwhile, more alcohol was being consumed than ever. Drinking and drugs became a huge problem for everyone, and our boss didn't care because it helped make the night more fun. Doing a toast before service was just called working on our personalities. We were reaching high levels of success, and it wasn't unusual for our boss to pop open a bottle of Krug or something super special to celebrate. She was generous in other ways, too. I often received gift cards to high-end spas, was taken out to nice dinners and karaoke parties, and invited into her family home. We also partied with some of the regulars at their houses and vacation houses. It was all so fun, until it wasn't. We were becoming burnt out, and side work duties weren't always getting done. Things got sloppy. Everyone had their own keys, there was no security, no cameras, basically no hierarchy. Despite frequent and various attempts to get rid of the mice and roaches, we never could. In my time there, we had many guests walk out because a roach crawled on them or their table. It was gross. We started a habit of loudly stomp dancing during service to scare mice from running out across the floor. And when we would see one, we pretended like we were shocked, as if it were the first time. Since I was so involved day and night, it became hard to separate the personal from the work. I started hating my job because of how tired I was, and when the pandemic rolled around, I didn't go back. No amount of glamour or luxury could help me cope. And then, in early 2022, a chef from this same restaurant and best friend of mine died very unexpectedly. Even though he was a core part of the team and built the culture from the ground up, and most everyone there called him one of their best friends, they did not close down service for the night. Everyone had to keep working through the tears. When shit hit the fan, money came first. They even stayed open on the day of his funeral, and most of the staff couldn't go because they had to work. It seems very obvious to me now that the family card was only pulled when it was convenient.
I've been working in the restaurant industry since I graduated college in 2014, but I actually started working in restaurants in 2015. I'm originally from Northern California, and being from San Helena and from Napa and Sonoma County, the two major industries are wine, tourism, and restaurants. So it just kind of seemed like the thing to kind of get into because I didn't know what I wanted to do. So here we are, 6-7 years later, and I'm still in the industry. And let me just say that I think it gets a pretty bad rap because there's always been this stigma around working in restaurants, or at least I have felt the stigma pretty intensely, because whenever people ask me like, oh, what do you do? And I say I work in restaurants, I always feel ashamed. And I think the feeling of being ashamed comes from that, like, technically it's a service industry and I am waiting on people. So therefore, people see me as less than. I feel like societally, we always kind of look down on service workers. I work at a tapas place in Healdsburg, California. And Healdsburg is right in the middle of Sonoma County. Healdsburg is an awesome town. It's super small, super chic. It's definitely come up in the past couple years. And I work at a really popular spa. It's super busy. During the summertime, we do like close to 300 covers a night. And yeah, it's honestly pretty badass. And I feel very grateful to be working at such a high volume and easygoing restaurant, in the sense that like there's so many different restaurants you can work at. You can go for the whole like Michelin star experience and work at a restaurant where you only have maybe a 5-table section and give people like super top-notch service. But I personally don't like working in places like that because it feels really stuffy and I feel like I can't be myself. And I've been blessed to work at a restaurant where I can fully be 100% myself and show my personality and be funny and sassy and a little bit like extra and sexy. And it's okay because most places in Healdsburg are pretty top notch. So even though it's not necessarily like Michelin star status or Montage status, it's definitely like people come in and you're not walking out of there spending less than $200 for two people. You know, I've had certain tables. I had these four women who were from Australia, and they pretty much went through 5 bottles of Billicard Salmon, which is a Brut Rosé, incredible, top tier. And they spent like, you know, $1,300 on a quick 2.5-3 hour lunch. So you kind of get the run of the gamut of clientele. You can get like your moms and dads with your kids coming out of soccer practice, and then people who are really looking to like bouge it up and, you know, drop some serious cash. So, and the thing about working in restaurants is I feel like it attracts a lot of misfits. Like, it's always creative people who don't necessarily know where they're going. People that are okay with being like, hey man, I don't really know what I'm doing right now, but I'm able to go in and work 6 hours and like talk it up and drink some booze and eat some food and make some cash and bounce. I think that overall, I work at a pretty PG-13, maybe like R occasionally rated restaurant. It's definitely cleaned itself up in the past couple years. There used to be managers that, you know, would sleep with some of the employees and, you know, get with some of the hostesses and then eventually be dating hostesses. And I do find that when we had these two managers who were honestly incredible, they definitely hired very good looking women, and that has still kind of created, like, has still seeped into the culture. Like, we still hire, I feel like whenever you're hiring front of house people, they're always good looking. But yeah, I feel like in the past, it was very blatant that they would hire good looking women that they were interested in, because they eventually ended up dating or sleeping with some of the hostesses and women at the restaurant. But yeah, a couple of funny stories is there used to be someone that worked at the restaurant that, you know, would sell cocaine to people in the back of the house and the front of the house. That was way before I worked there. This was like probably 5 years ago. But there was also this other waitress. This was before I worked there too. She was like super loaded on coke, had obviously had some shots at the bar, and had a full section Saturday night, like 8 tables slamming. We're having a great time. And she straight up leaves her whole section and doesn't come back. She just walks out of the restaurant. She just leaves the restaurant, and everyone's like, okay, so here we have, I don't know, 25 customers who have literally lost a waitress. We have no idea where she's gone. We don't even know where her tables are at. There also used to be just one bathroom in the restaurant, and there was this little kind of like drawer, sort of like furniture piece that would hold all the toilet paper. And it probably took maybe like 2 years before management found out that it was blatantly being used to do lines off of. I think they maybe saw some white dust there and stuff was left behind. Another good story is back to when we only had the one bathroom, is the bathroom had been locked for probably like, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes. And obviously managers have a key just in case. And this one table is like, hey, I'm kind of worried. Like, my girlfriend has been in the bathroom for a really long time. I know this is kind of weird, but do you mind going to go check on her? And of course, our manager was like, yeah, no problem. Absolutely. So he goes with the boyfriend to go check on her. And he opens the door, full blown having sex with another guy in the bathroom. So he quickly closes the door and tells the boyfriend that he's happy to have a drink of whatever he wants on the house at the bar while he waits, if he even wants to. Whenever shit like that happens, I always want to know. I'm always like, wish that I could contact the people and know how it actually ended up playing out for them. I think that overall, I've had a really good experience working in restaurants. You definitely can make a decent amount of money. And it's kind of like a double-edged sword because I now make what some of my friends who have been in corporate positions make who have been at the company for 5 years. Now, they can, in a way, have more of a leg up than me because they have the ability to continue to climb the corporate ladder, so to speak. I feel like when working in a restaurant, you kind of hit a certain cap. And, you know, like I have been very lucky where I work at a very nice place that has a lot of high volume. So therefore, the tips that I make are very decent and we are always busy. You can definitely not make anything at a restaurant if you work at like, you know, a small mom and pop shop that like barely has any tables and doesn't have good clientele. So it's like being a waitress is kind of like being an independent contractor and figuring out what works for you. Like, do you want to do more fine dining? Like, do you want to do more fine dining and have a small table section and really get good at sales and your wine knowledge and your food knowledge and upsell? Or do you feel more comfortable just kind of grinding it out and moving quickly and trying to turn tables as quickly as you can? The taboo topics of working in a restaurant and the sense of it like not being so mainstream and people kind of looking down on it are changing. At least in the town of Healdsburg, I've noticed that many restaurants are now adopting health insurance for all their employees, which like 5 years ago was never a thing. That camaraderie and that feeling that you have when you're going to school with, you know, a bunch of different personalities is kind of what it's like working in a restaurant. You're seeing each other in like stressful situations and just life situations. Like, let's say you come into work and you just had like a terrible day. Like, I don't know, maybe someone in your family is dying or you've just lost a bunch of money on one of your side hustles or you're just like having a rough go and you have to be nice to people and you have to put on a face. And then maybe your coworkers catch you crying in the walk-in or, you know, yelling, you know, and hitting the fucking ramekins or the Cambros full of whatever the fuck to try and get your anger out. And they're just like, are you okay? And it's like, you have this vulnerability and this rawness that you allow your coworkers to see that I don't think you really see in other industries. And I was thinking that maybe that's the reason why I've kind of been hesitant to go into corporate America is because I feel like I wouldn't be able to show my true self and my true colors because also in the restaurant industry, there's not like the formalities, you know, like you're calling people bitch, you're saying fuck this table, fuck this. Like you don't have to be so PC about it. And it's just accepted. By that being the case, you can just show your true colors.
Once again, degenerate ladies and gentlemen, and those of you who identify as neither, I'm Allie Weiss, and you've been listening to Tales of Taboo. You can follow me on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter, all at Allie Weiss World, and the podcast on TikTok at Tales of Taboo. If you enjoyed what you heard, and you know what, especially if you didn't, please consider leaving a rating and review on iTunes and Spotify. It's truly the quickest and easiest way to support the show. I know all podcasters ask for this, but my case is unique because the easier it is for new listeners to find the show, the more anonymous confessions we potentially have access to, and the bigger and more impactful the show can become. I also have the cutest sweatshirts and G-strings emblazoned with Degenerate available as merch, which you can purchase from me via Instagram DM. Again, that's at Allie Weiss World. I have sizes small through 2XL available. Tales of Taboo is conceived, produced, and narrated by me, Allie Weiss. Audio production by Isabel McMahon, Christophopoulos, WTF Media, and Gotham Production. Cover photo by Erica Flynn. Cover art by Kristen Montenegro. Theme song by Christathopoulos. And, of course, none of this would be possible without the time, effort, and trust of each and every anonymous confessor. From the bottom of my heart, thank you.